This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are huge fans of the Hemingway Review. We always read it to see the latest scholarship. You can buy back issues of the Hemingway Review at hemingwaysociety.org/journals. Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, with Michael Von Cannon producing. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Well, if you're having one of those days where you feel like methodically knocking people's hats off, we have the perfect cure for you. Today, we are delighted to devote a show to Hemingway and the sea, with particular emphasis on his work as a response to Herman Melville's. What is the difference between The Old Man and the Sea and Moby Dick, other than a few hundred pages? How is Hemingway operating within and without the same tradition of American literature? For this discussion of Hemingway, his sea narratives, and Melville, we welcome an old Nantucketer, a guest we have been hoping to welcome to One True Podcast from the beginning, Nathaniel Philbrick. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of 13 books, 7 of them New York Times bestsellers, including In the Heart of the Sea, the winner of the 2000 National Book Award, Mayflower, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History, and Valiant Ambition, winner of the George Washington Prize. He is also the author of Why Read Moby Dick, and we also recommend an excellent article in the Hemingway Review about the possible influence of the Grand Armada chapter in Moby Dick on Hemingway's short story, After the Storm. Nat has lived on Nantucket Island since 1986, and we welcome him to One True Podcast. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome.
Mark, it's great to be here.
Well, it's fantastic to have you. You know, I mentioned in the introduction about The Old Man and the Sea and Moby Dick, I had a colleague who literally just asked me that very question. What is the difference between The Old Man and the Sea and Moby Dick? So maybe we can start there. What are the parallels? Where's the overlap? And what are the differences? How do you see those two works?
It's an obvious comparison, I guess, but boy, are they different books, because they're just such different authors, entirely different sensibilities, and yet joined, I think, by one thing, their love and reverence for the sea. And, you know, what's interesting, Melville's became a writer because of his experience on a whale ship. I mean, that's really the fundamental experience that sent him in the direction that would ultimately lead to Moby Dick and all the other books. And you know, with Hemingway, it's the war. It's it being a kid in Michigan, and he comes to the sea, you know, relatively late when he, you know, discovers Key West and Cuba and all that kind of stuff in the 30s. And what's amazing to me is how precise he is. I mean, it's just who he was, how the precision of his observations, of his ability to tonally and emotionally create what it is like to be alive and on the sea. And that is ultimately what the two share. They just go about it very differently. And so with, you know, Old Man and the Sea, you know, there he is. It's one-on-one, you know, man versus the beast with the sea as a backdrop. You know, it's a very tight focus. It's all right there. And then Melville, typically, it all becomes the voyage, the ship, the whale becomes the excuse for him to venture into the stratosphere, not only linguistically, but philosophically. you know, they just go at it entirely differently, but what they have in common is that incredible engagement with the reality of life, basically, whether it be at sea or ashore.
So with Santiago, he's fishing for his survival and for his livelihood. And for Ahab, it's a completely different reason, right? It's for vengeance. Do you find yourself rooting for Ahab the way that you root for Santiago? And if so, why would you be rooting for Ahab?
Well, you know, I think, I mean, we all have more Ahab in us than we would like to admit.
True.
I mean, that, you know, as Melville says in Moby Dick, all true greatness is disease. And, you know, yeah, I mean, there's a nobility to the man. Ahab has his humanity, but he's off the rails. You know, he has lost it. And, you know, so I, you know, there is there's a part of me that's rooting for him, but you know, what makes it so such a terrifying book is how beguiling, someone like Ahab is. How, you know, he draws in even Ishmael, one of the great sane, characters. You know, he's kind of like a Santiago, I won't say with a brain, but, you know, a Santiago, who has a lot of the Melville in him. You know, you love the guy. He's the ultimate survivor. He's the one who was left to tell the tale. And, but he is drawn into the spell of that Ahab, radiates. And, you know, and so it's that for me is what makes the book as important as it is, as fundamental as it is that he shows there is the darkness, but there is, all of us have to recognize that we have some of the darkness in us. And, you know, it's a lesson that is continually reinvented with each generation of readers.
That's a great point. It also brings to mind that if Santiago were beguiling, he would have lured the boy onto this doomed voyage, going out farther than when anybody had ever gone before. And then perhaps it would have drawn him into a kind of a maritime disaster, the way that Ahab is.
Yeah.
There seems to be something that Hemingway wants his protagonist to be alone. And in Moby Dick, it's a group. It's not only a group, it's a group of different types of people from all different parts of the world. Do you think that is sort of illustrative of their vision, of their separate vision, that Hemingway has a man all by himself?
Hemingway is, it's me and the universe. With Melville, it's a society. It's, you know, that's what he's showing. You know, there's 30 crew members and there were 30 states in the Union. That's what he's playing with. And the other thing that with Melville, he is, you know, it's if the entire DNA of America is in that book in some form or another. You know, it's, from my perspective, it's almost biblical, in its expansiveness, in its inclusiveness. And yet it has this remarkable ability to remain relevant, and seem even more relevant as we go into the uncharted unknown of the future. And what part of that is, it's not a sentimental book. It is not a, you know, there's, it's, it is what it is. And what's interesting about, I think that's the flaw in Old Man the Sea, is Hemingway is normally unflinching, when it comes to, sentimental, you know, an unsentimental view of the world, but not an Old Man in the Sea. He likes Santiago too much. And I think it's wonderful. We love him. And it makes the book, so accessible, to a wide audience. But, you know, ultimately, you know, I think it could have been edgier. But perhaps, you know, it wouldn't have been that. So, you know, here I am quibbling about one of the great books of all time. But no, it is different.
That's interesting. You say that Melville doesn't make Moby Dick sentimental, but there is, of course, humanity. I remember the scene where Ahab sheds one teardrop and he's thinking of his wife. Very short chapter. And you think that just when you think that Ahab is a monster, Melville reminds you, right? There is that humanity. He's a human being with true emotions, with huge emotions as a character.
That is what makes it all the more tragic, you know, where, you know, if Ahab was this, you know, one dimensional caricature of evil, that would be safe. But no, and you go into it thinking, who is this demonic soul? It's like Wagner, you know, he's in there. But then, you know, as we're building towards the big climax, you know, that's where, you know, Ahab and Starbuck have that wonderful exchange. And, you know, we learn about, Ahab's wife back home and, you know, all of this stuff. And it just, you know, it's an amazing job of giving him enough of a human background to sort of care about the guy, but then you realize, man, how far he has strayed, how the purpose of this revenge has mangled him as much as his leg, as much as that scar, you know, across his face.
So, Nat, and we're talking about some of the differences between The Old Man and the Sea and Moby Dick. Would you say, in your perspective as a historian, that with the novel Moby Dick, Melville is talking about the state of America as it is and the future, as you were saying, with the different crew members? He might be warning us about the dangers of tyranny or fascism in the way that Ahab leads, and other political, let's say, concerns that were in the air at the time, the Civil War, slavery. But that is absent The Old Man and the Sea. Do you see any kind of commentary in The Old Man and the Sea, or is that more, let's say, hewed to the actual narrative?
Yeah, I mean, with Old Man and the Sea, you know, we know almost precisely when it's happening. You know, it's Joe DiMaggio, it's, you know, his favorite baseball player, you know, so we have those very specific details. Yeah. So, you know, once again, so different from Melville, where, you know, it's, yeah, there's Nantucket, but it's, you know, it's really iffy about when this is, you know, it's vague. It's almost mythic, where it's very, you know exactly where Santiago is and in time and place. It's the human soul against the ravaging universe in The Old Man and the Sea, where in Melville, it's coming from the place of, I mean, this is what's interesting about Moby Dick. I mean, he wrote this as his father-in-law is in the midst of dealing with the Fugitive Slave Act. His father, you know, was on the state Supreme, you know, was a judge of hearing this case in which a escaped enslaved man had made it to Boston and was, and the slave catchers got him. And, he had to make a decision, you know, does he uphold this new law, the Fugitive Slave Act, which is only a year is, you know, came about as part of the compromise of 1850. You know, the country is hell bent on a course towards some kind of catastrophe. And that's in the book. And as a concept, but it's in a way that is so, generalized and yet, boy, specific in its details that whatever time you read this book, you see what's going on in your life, you know, unfolding. You know, how many times has Ahab been compared to a political figure, you know, a historic, you know, it's just endlessly relevant. And that, you know, it's like Shakespeare, his ability where he took, you know, his Elizabethan times, and created these timeless dramas out of them by channeling what was happening, just that heat of the moment stuff that was happening then, but leaving it ultimately untethered from any time. And man, that is a trick. That is, you know, to make the reality of being in those kinds of times, those catastrophic, on the edge of the end of the world, and making it something that people who have not been born yet will be able to relate to.
Let me ask you to consider something, and if it makes no sense, don't hesitate to tell me. So is it possible to view Moby Dick, the novel, as if you just took, let's say, The Chase, that sequence of chapters that are The Chase, if you distilled the actual landing of Moby Dick, and if you, in other words, the action scenes, and you could make that like Melville's The Old Man and the Sea, or conversely, if you took something like The Sun Also Rises and then added the nonfiction work about bullfighting, like Death in the Afternoon and The Dangerous Summer, that could be his version of Moby Dick. So basically, if you took three volumes, that could be Hemingway's version of Moby Dick. Or if you took a fraction of Moby Dick, that would be his version of Hemingway. Is there any substance to that question?
Oh, I think that's very provocative. I like it. I
mean, I'm exhausted, but I'm happy that it was provocative.
Yeah, right? No, because I mean that's it. You know, Hemingway had his journalism, and which is great. I mean, you know, and it's you are there kind of journalism, but it's such a different mode from his fiction. Yeah, and then Melville has that. You know, Moby Dick is all over the map. every genre of literature is contained in it, you know, whether it's scientific treatise, meets, you know, poetry, iambic pentameter poetry meets,
plays.
And sure. In those chase scenes, I mean, that is the, literary equivalent of a car chase in the Fast and Furious, you know, where you build to that ultimate chase. I mean, that it's so cinematographic, you know, it's orchestral in terms of there's crashing cymbals. This whole book has been building to this. And, it is just so exciting. The writing is, very precise, visual. And it's so different from what we've had. And, so I like that. I like that where, you know, you take Melville down to the action sequences,
right,
and you juice up, Hemingway with some of his journalism.
Because I'm reading, let's say in Death in the Afternoon, that's Hemingway's 1932 bullfighting disquisition. And he's talking on and on about some nuance of bullfighting that I don't know and I don't really care about. And I say, when was the last time I felt like this? Ah, the cetology chapter of Moby Dick. It's the same exact thing. Well, let's talk about in Green Hills of Africa, which is Hemingway's 1935 nonfiction account of his safari. He actually addresses Melville directly. What are his comments about it? How do you take them?
He talks about, you know, what the good parts of Melville are, the reality in them. The rhetoric is what disgusts him in a way. And he's very similar to Conrad's reaction to Melville. Although I think Hemingway saw a little more benefit in Melville than Conrad did. And it's interesting that it would be in that book, you know, that Hemingway refers to Melville. And I think, you know, it's the hunt,
right.
Africa, the savannah, all of that. It's sort of like going to the Great Plains of the United States. It's wide open. It's a big sky country, and it's very oceanic in the feeling it gives you when you're out there amid these great distances with the endless horizon. And so, Hemingway had a tortured relationship with every author, living or dead. And he was a tremendously competitive guy. And to get any kind of praise out of him is kind of unusual.
It's usually qualified, right?
It's always
got an exception. Yeah,
you know, and I think it probably, I know it irritated Hemingway that Moby Dick was the great literary test of the the intelligentsia in Paris in the 20s. You know, they were discovering it, and it was the cool book. And, you know, if you were a cool person, you admitted to your love of this great book. And, you know, that's just the kind of thing where Hemingway's going to go, yeah, been there. I read that in high school, and my teacher didn't even assign it, you know, done that. And so I've moved so far beyond.
What do you think he means by the things themselves, the actualities? What kind of reality does he find in Moby Dick as opposed to the rhetoric?
You know, and I referred to it earlier in a way, but not, once again, not with the precision of Hemingway. But, you know, what Melville, I mean, any great author, the reason we continue to read them is that they provide us with a window into what it was like to be alive at that specific time. I mean, that is the essence of great literature. It's really hard to do, to communicate that, you know, what it is like to be alive, to have the sensations, the smells, the touch, the sense of fear and elation, all of that. It's really hard to communicate that way, that in a way that someone will want to read it in 100 years. And it's very specific. You know, it's connecting, you know, it's like the Puritans in the Bible. It's an unmediated experience in a way. And Melville is always mediated, you know, he has that core, but he loves to play with it. He loves to mediate it. He loves to use it, to spin it into a metaphor of some kind. And that just, I think, enraged Hemingway. You know, said, dude, don't mess with it. You know, you've got this could be brilliant, but there you go, muck it up with, you know, your linguistic games or whatever. Everyone has their weaknesses. You know, Hemingway could become a parody of himself, what you see in Green Hills of Africa, where, you know, he has such a hypnotic voice. It's just, you know, and he can just slip into that and talk about anything and eventually you end up saying, wait a minute. This does not have the plums in the pudding.
The rhetoric refers to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nat, in your book about the origin story of the novel Moby Dick, it's called In the Heart of the Sea. And there's something in that title that's ominous and dark, and it prefigures the kind of danger that those characters found in the heart of the sea. Do you think that Hemingway's vision of the sea was similar to Melville's? Did he have a different experience in the way that he presents it?
No, I think actually very similar. And you know, anyone who has spent a considerable amount of time at sea can't help but have, I think, a similar view. You know, you can wax poetic about it, but ultimately, the sea just does not give a damn, and it's powerful, and it's, you know, it's going to get you at some point. And, not, you know, whether it's a malignant thing or not depends on your point of view, but ultimately, you know, and both, I think, have that, you know, that's there. What is fascinating to me is how different they are, in what they do with it, even though it's the same, you know, I think pretty much the same view of what the sea is, you know, and the sea is ultimately a stand-in for the universe, for life. You know, I mean, Melville spent his life in search of religious belief. He wanted to believe that there was something more, but he never could. But as Hawthorne would observe in a wonderful journal account of their meeting, that they're seeing each other in Liverpool on the sand hills there, you know, that Melville deserved to believe, but he didn't. And Hemingway is at the point, oh, come on, why are you even wanting to believe? Yeah. You know, look at this is what it is, you know, at least enjoy the hunt, you know.
One of the things that is striking about The Old Man and the Sea is, as the novella goes along, Santiago begins to identify with the marlin. And when he strikes the marlin, he says, it was as if Santiago himself had been struck. I can't tell who is pulling who in? Is it me or is it the fish? So it becomes a sort of an identification predator to the prey. Do you think Melville dramatizes that same dynamic with Ahab and the whale?
That's a good question. You know, no. I mean, it's different. You know, if you're going to get specific about the whale, Moby Dick and Ahab, you know, what is their relationship? Well, you know, they had a bad...
There's conflict.
Yeah, there is conflict. And, you know, and what's interesting is in Melville's telling, you know, the whale is just so alien to human perception. He does not anthropomorphize it at all. You know, I mean, you're not, you know, he does in the Armada, Grand Armada scene where, you know, there they are chasing in a whale boat, chasing this huge pod of whales and, that has been gollied. That is, you know, just, all in confusion and chaos until they get to the center of this mass of whales and it's quiet. And, it's this calm in the storm and they gaze down and there are, you know, mother whales and their babies and, you know, and he's humanizing the whale there, you know, so yeah, he can do that there, but it's, you know, it's not like they're saying, oh, that's just like me kind of thing. It's not that identification of self, I think. And then when it comes to Moby Dick, my gosh, I mean, it's just this force, this cosmic entity that is beyond any kind of identification, I think.
So the last question about these two books. So both writers had to, well, I guess they had the choice. So Melville could have had Ahab kill the whale and then be happy, kill the whale and then not be happy, not kill the whale and then be happy, or not kill the whale and not be happy. So he had those four, Melville had those four choices, just as Hemingway did with Santiago. And again, spoiler alert, I figure everybody listening knows how both books end. Why do you think Melville and Hemingway both end these sort of holy grail quests in the same or a similarly tragic way?
Yeah. Well, because tragedy ultimately is the only resolution that is true to the fact that we're all going to die. any a happy ending is just a temporary, refusal to see where it's going because it's not going to end happy. It's, you know, you can say, well, at least my kids will go on. Well, they're going to die too.
Yeah.
I mean, this is where, so if you're going to be absolutely faithful to this wonderful world we live in, it's got to end in tragedy. And, you know, and that's where I don't, you know, there are very few timeless books where, you know, it all ends with people hugging each other and little hearts coming out of their heads.
Ishmael has of course, it's a tragic ending, but Ishmael is probably the happiest of them all. What becomes of Ishmael?
You know, what becomes? That's a very good question. What becomes? Well, he writes it down.
Yeah.
And I think, he becomes Herman Melville,
yeah,
in a way. You know, he is Ishmael, rootless on the desert, wandering those sand hills in Liverpool, looking for something he can never have, but with a story to tell. And ultimately a survivor until, you know, he won't be.
Speaking of Ishmael and speaking of the Grand Armada, which you mentioned, I wonder if you could say a few words about how you approached the Grand Armada chapter with respect to After the Storm, Hemingway's short story, only because Ishmael, as we're saying, is so philosophical, and a narrator like the one in After the Storm seems antithetical to that. So how did you connect those two pieces?
I don't think I had read After the Storm until I came upon it, after having moved to Nantucket and becoming curious about Hemingway, largely because of my friendship with Susan Beagle, who at that time was living on Nantucket and one of the few friends I had with similar interests in literature and things like that. And her husband, Wes Tiffany, was one of the great souls. And I had loved Hemingway, but I hadn't really explored his relationship with the sea. And so After the Storm came to me as an absolute revelation. How, once again, it was the precision of his engagement with what it's like to be at sea, to talk about the sea. So that for me, that was like, wow. And then I'm reading this account of a wreck where he's, you know, and it's just, he creates this sense of, you know, looking down upon a wreck and seeing this woman's, a form of a woman floating inside the wreck through a porthole. And it just hit me. My God, this is the Grand Armada turned inside out, you know, with, you know, almost mocking the anthropomorphizing that's going on in that chapter of Moby Dick, and just taking it to the other. And so it's just, for me, it was, wow, you know, this is kind of an intriguing way to look at Hemingway's short story and Melville as well, because, what's interesting too is, Hemingway visited, Nantucket with his mother when he was 11 and, so had a connection to the island even long before he read Moby Dick. And, you know, I was living on the island and, it was for me kind of my personal experience of the sea. I'm a big sailor. I used to be a competitive, sailboat racer. And to sort of pull that together for me was, you know, really suggestive it was a fun article to write.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Also that both writers are taking actual historical events and then embellishing them into fiction, your article is quite interesting. To talk about After the Storm. We've had Susan Beagle on the show, and we've also had Kirk Kernut on to talk about After the Storm, as a particularly Key West narrative. One of the chapters of Moby Dick that I wonder if you can talk about with respect to Hemingway is the monkey rope. So maybe you could summarize what is so interesting about the monkey rope. But the issue with that chapter is that it talks about metaphysics in a way that I'm not sure Hemingway ever approaches. And I don't know if you, how you feel about that connection. Could you say a few words about the monkey rope?
Yeah, the monkey rope is, it's one of those incredible chapters in an incredible book. But the monkey rope, what happens when you have killed a whale and you bring it to the beside a ship to pull off the blubber and chop it up and boil it into the oil? You have this huge carcass beside the ship and you have this hook, this big industrial sized hook that you need to get into the blubber to start peeling it off the carcass the way you would peel an orange. And so someone has to get down on the carcass. And, you know, and it's like a rolling log, you know, it's a very dangerous perch, and inevitably you're surrounded by sharks that are feasting themselves on the dead whale and all that blood. And, what they would have, is a rope tied to this man around his waist that if he should fall, they could pull him out. Melville / Ishmael does with this is it's Queequeg on the whale in the midst, you know, the ship's lurching, there's sharks down there snapping away. And, you know, he's trying to get this damn, hook into the whale blubber and Ishmael has the monkey rope, which, tied to him so that their two fortunes are united through this slender line. Yeah. And this is typical Melville, you know, taking, you know, this becomes the metaphor of, you know, two human beings sharing the same fate and all this kind of thing.
The umbilical cord, right? It's
yeah, it's the umbilical cord. Yeah. And it is, and it's great. And, you know, and it takes a situation where we're all tied to others one way or another, whether we, admit it or not. And I think Melville admits it. I think Hemingway tried to not admit it. I think Hemingway had a hard time admitting any kind of dependence on anyone but himself. I think Hemingway's sensibility is incapable of, perhaps pulling this kind of trick off. I think, you know, it's different.
It's strange because Hemingway often writes about men at war who are in platoons and with other soldiers. And you would think that the consciousness of that kind of codependency might make it into a novel. But I mean, what he would say in A Farewell to Arms is, Pacini was between me and the bomb, right? That's why I'm here. But there's never really kind of a philosophical elaboration the way that Melville does it.
With Hemingway, it's not a band of brothers,
right?
What I mean? They're all victims one way or another. There isn't that sense of connection.
It's a separate piece. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Separate piece. Yeah. Yeah.
This may seem absurd to talk about with respect to Melville and Moby Dick, but does he use any version of the iceberg theory where he uses omission and implication the way Hemingway does, or is it all out there?
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I mean, they're such different sensibilities. You know, well, let's look at the composition of Moby Dick. He began to write a very different book. Initially, it was going to be a little bit more like Redburn, more of a or White Jacket, something which was, you know, the tone of the beginning of the book, which is humorous, which is kind of an adventure, almost a Don Quixote kind of thing, and then he went dark, and out of the beginnings of that book, he created something different. So, you know, is that an iceberg? Has he chopped away the humorous, whatever and found the core? No, I think it's an entirely different book. And part of the rough-hewn nature of Moby Dick is that he didn't really, it kind of veers. And, you can sort of, you know, see the architectural, the mess that was created by that narrative upheaval. And, it's interesting. I think he wasn't paring it down so much as this was just wherever he was going. And this book was going to, you know, he was meandering through his mind and through whatever, always coming back to the pursuit of the whale. But the iceberg is a lot of it's above the surface of the water with Melville.
I also wonder if the chapter "The Whiteness of the Whale" is at all related to the iceberg theory, because one of the things that Ishmael points out about whiteness is that it's omission, it's absence, and there's something about absence that makes people pretty anxious, that we don't really have our bearings. And is there any kind of artistic association with whiteness that you see?
With Melville, yeah, it's terrifying. It's a blank. It's without color, and that's what makes Moby Dick so terrifying. You know, it's nature that has just nothing about it. That has gentle hues, have those rosy cheeks. It's a pallor of death. And so, you know, and that's, I think Hemingway could relate to that.
like the whiteness of the page.
Yeah.
If you're facing that, sometimes that can be pretty horrifying.
Tell us all about it. Yeah.
Do you have a game we love to play on One True Podcast? Do you have one true sentence from Moby Dick?
It's got to be for me. I'm sorry. This is just too obvious, but call me Ishmael. I mean, for me, that when I was a kid, you know, I thought my father taught the book. So I thought, oh, this has to be the worst book ever. And I was made to read it when I was a senior in high school. And I started reading it and I was harpooned. I mean, it was that call me Ishmael. I mean, this was the best friend I had never had. You know, a damp, drizzly November of, you know, your soul. God, that's every teenager who's ever gone to high school. And so for me, that's it, because, you know, it's gesturing you in. It's, you know, call me Ishmael. And, you know, and it's a confidence. It's not who he is, obviously, but call me Ishmael.
Is call me Ishmael completely welcoming, or is it a little bit putting you on edge on his terms? If I said, my name is Mark, call me X, is there anything shifty about it, or you're taking it as a complete?
No, I think it's entirely shifty. Okay. That I didn't realize at, you know, I was there with him at the beginning and saying, oh, call me Ishmael. And you go, wait, who is this dude?
Right.
He is strange. And he, you know, and there's reasons for going on the voyage. It's, you know, that's why it was so beguiling to me. It was a misdirection from the beginning and, you know, but toying with you in a wonderful way. And, you know, and that's, I think, the underappreciated aspect of the book where, you know, Ahab is playing a confidence game, with the crew, but Ishmael is playing a confidence game with the reader too.
One of the things that for me calls call me Ishmael into question is that second sentence. Sometime, never mind precisely how he's setting the terms of the discussion, isn't he?
Yeah. He is. Yeah. That whole first chapter, it's just such a tour de force.
It's great.
And I just, you know, I don't know how, you know, the sensibility that was able to do that. I mean, I don't, he wasn't able to ever do it again, but isn't that the way it is with all great books?
Does Hemingway have a first sentence of a novel or a short story that is similarly legendary?
Well, you know, for me, it's funny because I really have come to love Hemingway's books about the sea, and not necessarily Old Man and the Sea. I love Islands in the Stream. Mm-hmm. And so the beginning of that book, it's for me, it's that first paragraph. Where he describes the house, Hudson's house, you know, built into the side of the island, so that it can, deal with hurricanes as best it can. I mean, it's just, wow. I mean, it's someone in that paragraph is so much, that most writers, that would be two chapters in, where you would get that. And it's all just etched in. And so I know the Nick stories are better and all that kind of stuff, but maybe it's just the slackness that comes with old age. I just love Islands in the Stream.
Did you respond to a story like Big Two-Hearted River?
Oh yeah. Yes. Oh my God. You know, and that has just about every sentence is true in that. It's, you know, and I think that, geez, I mean, you write something like that. How can you go on? I mean, you guess it's just so good. And, you know, I was, one of my books is The Last Stand about, the Battle of Little Bighorn. And when I was on book tour with that, I ended up in a bookstore in Michigan up where, Hemingway would spend his summers. And Libby Custer spent the first summer after her husband's death in a cabin that's still there, which is right next to where the Hemingways stayed. And they're all still there. You know, it's plumbing that's turned off for the winter and all that stuff. And for me, that was like, wow. that talk about cosmic combination of different things that, you know, Custer and Hemingway.
That's incredible. And well, Big Two-Hearted River is what we can see that Nick talks about the mechanics of camping and the mechanics of fishing. And that could be like going back to what you were saying earlier about the, about what he admired about Melville, about the real actualities, not just the poetic flourishes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you read Moby Dick. If you were a Martian, you could create what 19th century whaling was from the details of that book. You read Big Two-Hearted River, you're from Venus, you could create the reality, you know, what he's doing. It's just so precise and so detailed, and psychological too, in a way. But, you know, that is for me their common ground, that makes them both timeless authors.
Well, Nat, maybe we can end on, I want to read a line from Hemingway's letter to Ezra Pound. This is 1930. Now, Hemingway often acted up in letters to Ezra Pound, so take it for what it's worth. But he writes, Melville is shit, but isn't it better to read him and find that out than be told what a great writer he is in college? So is Hemingway showing off? Is he doing the kind of rebellion that every writer has to do to previous generations? Or what is he, what's behind that kind of invective?
He's showing off. And I think there's, you know, I don't know how drunk he was when he wrote it, but I mean, he's probably, you know, when he, he's, you know, that for him, that's the default setting. Is he's shit, even though everybody says it's whatever. And I think clearly, he also, you know, listed Melville as one of the authors he was trying to beat, and for an author of his sensibilities, there is a lot of shit in, Moby Dick. I think he's being truthful to his vision in a way, but you know, like a lot of things, that's where he gets into problems is when he's posturing, and it just doesn't quite measure up to what he's trying to pull off.
Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you so much for joining us on One True Podcast. This has been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been really fun. Great to talk with you.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is supported by the Hemingway Society, the English Department at the University of Evansville, and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast. I'm not